providers. So this isn't the only, this report isn't the only thing we're doing to improve services and ensure better community safety. I need to also mention the work of the Community and Police Relations Committee under the Human Rights Commission that has been doing a lot of good work with community members and police officers, talking and listening to each other and figuring out how to improve relationships, as has Polo Catalani in the Office of Human Relations working with immigrant refugee communities. So this is one piece of the puzzle and one piece of the solutions, and I greatly appreciate the work that's been done. Aye.
Adams.
Well, I think first I want to thank Director Batista and Auditor Griffin Belay and the team at the Independent Police Review for moving forward very expeditiously in the reforms proposed by Commissioner Leonard and the auditor and others. The work continues, and you have in the Police Bureau a partner that is intent on not just the input actions, but actually seeing the results and the reform. So we have a number of inquiries underway, we are making sure that, for example, the FBI Civil Rights Inquiry, Division Inquiry that Commissioner Saltzman and I and the community called for, that that's well coordinated as well in terms of the scope of that inquiry, and make sure that that you folks, if you haven't already, are part of the outreach and testimony taking from the Civil Rights Division. So what we're working on right now is, in the next week or so, we're putting together sort of the master template of all the reforms and provide a way for the public to better keep track of the status of each of those reforms. So more work to do. Thank you. Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for time certain 10:30, item number, emergency ordinance, item number 589.
Adopt and authorize the submission of the 2011-2016 Consolidated Plan, the fiscal year 2011-12 Action Plan application for the Community Development Block Grant, Home Investment Partnership, Emergency Shelter Grant, and housing opportunities for persons with AIDS programs, and the 2011 analysis of impediments to fair housing choice to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Commissioner Nick Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. Every 5 years, we're required to do a comprehensive plan and submit it to HUD as a condition of receiving federal funds. It's a monumental undertaking, which we do in partnership with all of our community friends. Today, Director Margaret Van Vliet will be presenting to us the various moving pieces. The two key things for us to review are the consolidated plan and the fair housing plan, which is based on the work of the Analysis of Impediments Committee. But I want to be clear that the fair housing plan that we're submitting to HUD is different from the fair housing action plan that we issued on Friday. That document, which Director Van Vliet and I developed based on the excellent work of the Analysis of Impediments Committee, will be coming to Council in the early fall for discussion and hopefully support. So, Margaret, I want to begin by thanking you and your team for the excellent work, in particular Jenny Kalas, Kim McCarty, Beth Kay, Kate Allen, and everyone who worked so tirelessly on this. Thank you. It's a wonderful document. Actually, Assistant Secretary HUD John Trezvino was with us on Friday, and he was quite complimentary of the work. I also want to acknowledge Danielle Ledesma of my team, who has just done yeoman's service on this and many other projects. Margaret.
Thank you, Mayor Adams and Commissioners. As Commissioner Fish said, I'm here to ask your approval to adopt three plans that HUD requires of us. There's the five-year consolidated plan that'll cover the years 2011 to 2016. The second is a one-year action plan, and the third is this analysis of impediments to fair housing choice report. And so the action you'll take today actually authorizes the city to apply to HUD for funding sources, mostly and most notably, Community Development Block Grant of $9 million, Home Investment Partnership Program grant of $4 million. Two smaller ones, the Emergency Shelter Grant of $440,000, and Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS, $1 million grant. And the details of that are in your materials. And I think you know that we are notified by HUD how much we're eligible to apply for, and it's notable that these amounts add up to about $2.4 million less than we were able to apply for and have been expending this year. And so we can talk another time about kind of what's going on with HUD budgets, but these amounts are reduced, and they are what we put into our budget for next year. So let me just quickly give you what the important things to know about the three plans. The consolidated plan, this five-year plan, has a snapshot of the community's housing and community development needs. It identifies local priorities and establishes the strategies that we'll use to address those priority needs. And it's developed with a lot of community process. And like a lot of things, HUD requires you to do some public participation. We do it in the Portland style and had many stakeholder meetings and public hearings. And we did this work in the process also of doing the new Bureau's strategic plan. So we had a lot of interest and a lot of good data and a lot of good sort of anecdotal information and prioritization conversations. So I want to tell you that the priorities that are articulated in the consolidated plan line up with the priorities that we established in the Bureau's strategic plan. And briefly, the top priority is increasing housing production and preservation, with an emphasis on rental housing for those who face the greatest challenges finding housing in the private market. This priority includes expenditures that identify and respond to discrimination in housing. Other priorities include homelessness prevention, foreclosure prevention, creating well-prepared new homeowners, particularly among households of color, and short-term shelter. The priorities also allow federal funds to be used for economic opportunity programs, and those are the funds that we send to PDC through our intergovernmental agreements. The other piece about the consolidated plan is includes five-year numeric goals, and then HUD holds us accountable to report on those goals each year in a report called the Consolidated Annual Performance Report, also known as the CAPER. The CAPER. Took me a long time to just remember there was no E in that acronym. So the second of the plans is the one-year action plan. And includes really how we're going to spend the federal funds in the fiscal year. Those, of course, are that action plan matches up quite nicely with the budget that we've put together for the next year. And then the third piece is the analysis of impediments to fair housing choice. HUD does require that it be done on the same schedule as the consolidated plan. I think you've heard a fair amount about the process we used to develop the analysis of impediments and the robust committee process and stakeholder involvement that informed this year's analysis and the recommendations that 23-member stakeholder committee offered to us and our jurisdictional partners. And that, as Commissioner Fish mentioned, serves as the basis for the Fair Housing Plan that we released last week. I think the other piece is I had thought I might be joined by one of our members. We have, in addition to the Analysis of Impediments Committee, you authorized the establishment of a Portland Housing Advisory Committee a few months ago. They've been meeting now for several months, and they have been deeply involved in helping us think about our planning work, our prioritization work. It's a broadly representative group of sort of housing experts, community development experts. And that will form the basis of our sort of the centerpiece, if you will, of our community engagement going forward and help one of our key accountability mechanisms. So I think I'm going to stop my presentation there, but I do want to give a special kudos to the staff member who's long held this this consolidated planning work, and that's Beth Kay. Nick mentioned the other key staff that had been working on this this year feverishly. They were guided by Beth Kay, who is going to be leaving us at the end of this month. But she's been a stalwart member of our team and a long-standing expert in these questions of HUD planning and regulatory compliance and public engagement. So her position was one that was eliminated in the recent budget reductions. We're going to miss her a lot, and I want to thank her today for her service.
You're here.
Thanks, Beth.
Another question?
Please.
I guess I'll preface it by saying I have a perception that single women do not have as much access to shelter. You know, if it's a single woman with kids, there's family shelter, you know, homeless men, there's definitely emergency shelters. Can you give me a gender split on access to emergency shelters for women versus men? I don't mean to hit you cold.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and I'm going to ask if any of my staff have the answer that are here and could address that.
Okay. Beth Kay? Commissioner Saltzman, members of council, I think that perhaps the best time to take that question up is going to be when the numbers come out for the homeless street and shelter count, because then we can provide a comparison by population and by number of units or beds or hotel and motel vouchers available, and that'll true it up. That information is in the plan. There's a need across all categories, but I can't give you a percentage.
And I'm not just talking about sort of the typical vision we have of somebody homeless in Old Town Chinatown.
Right.
You know, it's more women fleeing abusive situations.
Yeah.
And so is that captured in?
It actually is captured. So next week we're going to be releasing what's known as the street count. And this, again, is another HUD-required exercise. But it includes people who are not permanently housed. So it's people who are literally sleeping on the street, people who are in shelters, people who are in transitional housing, and to the best of our ability to count them, folks who otherwise are maybe doubled up or sleeping in cars or have sort of other very temporary arrangements. We think we had a good process that will allow us to capture all those kind of hidden populations, and we'll be releasing that next week and be happy to come back and
jump
talk
in,
about
though,
that.
Just, Dan's question, which is, it seems to me what we could do in response to the request is we could give him a snapshot based on the street count. We could take a look at, pull the sections of the comp plan that talk about who we're serving, what the breakdown is. We could also ask our partner Home Forward, formerly known as HAP, to tell us about the Section 8, the emergency vouchers that are going to victims of domestic violence with or without women with or without kids. And then we could give him the profile of how that fits within the overall system. And I'm going to anticipate that both Commissioner Saltzman and Commissioner Fritz, at a minimum, are going to want to push us a little bit on what additional things we can do to align with other systems that are being enhanced deal with them. And I think it's a great question. Let's start by pulling all the data, and then let's have the conversation about what additional tools we can bring to the table.
Okay, my final question, so I appreciate that and look forward to that information. You mentioned emergency shelter funding through vouchers for hotels, motels. And then Commissioner Fish just mentioned Home Forward has Section 8 vouchers geared towards maybe domestic violence victims. Do the emergency shelter vouchers that you're talking about, can those also fund the needs of domestic violence victims that want to find temporary shelter?
Absolutely, absolutely. And what we know is that we do this work through community-based nonprofits. And so there's a question of who comes in their door And then how can they access something like a short-term rent assistance or a motel voucher or things of that nature? They are being served. Certainly they wouldn't be turned away from any of the community-based nonprofits that do that work on our behalf. But I'm not equipped to tell you today how many are coming through the door and how that relates to the rest of the population.
And I guess if you could also get back to me whether the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services, which mm-hmm. does serve as a gateway
Absolutely.
For women seeking help. I know we have a nonprofit there. Provider mm-hmm. that has vouchers, but they hotel vouchers, but they often run out real quick.
Yep.
And I know the Gateway Center itself has some limited vouchers, I guess.
Correct. Right.
So we'd be interested in more vouchers for women, and so if you could maybe get back
what
on
we'll
that
do,
too.
What we'll do, Commissioner Saltzman, is, and we have a number of spreadsheets that we've already prepared and circulated. We'll pull them all together. Mm-hmm. We'll give you a briefing on the current system, who we're serving, what are the tools, and then and seek your guidance as to ways we might enhance those services. So
yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate that discussion and Commissioner Salson bringing this up. I'm not seeing in the fair housing assessment where it calls out the needs of single women. On page 17, there's the low-income and vulnerable populations, mm-hmm. but it doesn't really talk about that specifically vulnerable population. The city did a study in 2004 on single homeless women and found at that time that, in fact, it wasn't people fleeing domestic violence, mm-hmm. That there were a number of different needs, and it was striking to me reading that study that it's very similar today.
Mm-hmm.
And that we know we have a 9-week waiting list for Jean's Place. So how do we keep women safe in the meantime? So I'm wondering about this report is presented to us today for adoption, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that that's an omission that ought to be. Is there any opportunity to amend this plan?
There are definitely opportunities to amend the plan. Somebody's tapping me on the shoulder. Kate Allen and Elisa Aguilera. So,
hey, welcome.
So, I apologize for being late.
So, Kate, I think, can
directly
feel
responsive to Commissioner Fritz's question. Two items. The analysis of impediments report, as you know, focused on the federally, state, and locally protected classes, so domestic violence victims as a class do not have that designation. What is important is the dialogue that happened around the analysis of impediments committee with regard to specific actions in their recommendations about reducing barriers for women who are in that situation when the record of police calls because of a domestic violence situation create an impediment to their being able to access housing. So there is in the Fair Housing the Fair Housing Committee recommendations in the report in front of you, a specific recommendation about reducing barriers that are created by, I've named one specific one, that were several that were addressed specifically to that population, to women who were where there was a barrier to fair housing created by that situation.
So this is only addressing protected classes, the fair housing.
Well, fair housing by definition only covers the protected classes at the federal, state, and local level. And women would be protected, a family status is covered, so a woman who's a victim of domestic violence who has children cannot be turned away from housing, but it doesn't specifically target, quote-unquote, victims of domestic violence.
It does specifically protect sex or gender, as we now call it. So the women who are because of their life experience, putting them in the situation of having to answer for police calls that were attributable to domestic violence, and the police call is used as a way to deny housing, and that was what the committee specifically addressed.
Well, I'm not really on the domestic violence. Domestic violence is part of it, but it's a bigger issue. So is gender a protected class?
It is.
So I think that there needs to be more in the plan to address gender challenges. And I'm wondering, how do we amend this? Is there any possibility to amend this plan at this point?
Can we do this in two steps? Can we sit with you and sort of go through where we think there are some specific protections and then get your feedback on where that can be increased.
I'm asking a much more basic question. I'm being asked to adopt this today. Mm-hmm. And so if I feel that there's places where it could be clearer, will there be a future opportunity to amend this?
Absolutely, yes.
When would that be?
I think we have to give public notice and we have to have some process, but we can take up amendments to our plan anytime. There's not a restriction on that.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. And then I also wanted to emphasize, I think there's a really good section on increasing accessibility as well as affordability. And we heard in the budget sessions how people with disabilities have special challenges, and that's a protected class, right? So I appreciate that and the fact that you had folks affected by disabilities on the committee. And I particularly like the section about increasing houses choices for people with disabilities that's in bold. I want to call out a piece that's not in bold, and that is to develop a range of housing and supportive services to better match the needs of different populations living with mental illness, since one size does not fit all. I really like the way that's phrased. What's the significance of what's in bold and what's not? Are we going to only work on what's in bold? This is on page 15.
The significance of the difference between things in bold or not bold?
Yes.
On what page again?
15.
We can provide an answer for that, but it might also be a good opportunity for Alisa Aguilera, who was a member of the committee, can speak to the committee's process to identify those things that were the priority, that is, take action this year in a plan that is to serve us for the next five.
Thank you.
Before you do that, I'd like to just follow up on something you said, Kate, to make sure I'm understanding this.
Okay.
Women affected by domestic violence are not per se a protected class
under
fair housing. But you said if they make repeated calls to police, that means there's a basis for landlords to deny them housing, and therefore there is a protected class angle there?
No. I was highlighting in particular a recommendation that the committee made to get at the issue. And when a history of police calls is used, a previous landlord might say, this resident had a history of police calls. The reason for the police calls could well be domestic violence. Mm-hmm. The committee felt it was important that we take action to clear that kind of a record from preventing a woman from being able to rent without any barrier or without that excuse from a landlord to say, there are police reports, therefore we won't rent to you.
And that's
it's like,
it.
What's the source of the police report?
That's if it in is, this report?
It is.
Okay.
Yes, that is a recommendation made by the committee.
And although domestic violence...
Introduce yourself.
Oh,
first.
Sorry. Alisa Aguilera with the Community Alliance of Tenants and one of the co-directors there. And although domestic violence is not a protected class under fair housing, we have been working on it at the state level at the Tenant Landlord Coalition. So this year we recently passed, we're able to get a piece adopted where women who were escaping domestic violence, who had children who were over 18, previously could not bring those children with them and break the lease, which prevented folks from leaving if they couldn't bring their children with them. And so we were able to clear up some of that. So we've been slowly working on that. You know, we are open to any feedback on being able to push over different pieces of legislation. Domestic violence is one we're
sensitive. Let me also just draw a distinction, because I think it's helpful in terms of going forward. We are required to submit these reports to HUD. They address a series of questions that HUD poses, and they are limited to the legal categories that we can address. The Fair Housing Action Plan that we'll be coming to council with is our action plan on how we want to remove barriers. And we define barriers as both at the front end, things that prevent people from exercising housing choice, and on the other side of the ledger, we view it as a necessity to expand the supply of housing and accessible housing so people can use it. So at the ground level here, any of the issues my colleagues raise today or in the future about barriers, about changes in the law, we can address as a council independent of the report to HUD. And I want to be very clear. We're required to file a report to HUD and address some questions. So, for example, currently At the federal level, sexual orientation is not a protected class. And so there is no protection. It was 23 years ago we brought families and people with disabilities into the protection of federal law. But today, sexual orientation is not protected. Now, interestingly, Mayor, the realtors, the National Association of Realtors, have gotten behind that change. But there's not the political will yet in the Senate to do that. So as to specific things people want to see here in Portland, changes in how we spend money, prioritization, changes in the law, that's something the council can address at any time as part of our jurisdiction. This is a plan that we're submitting to HUD, which addresses a community process and sets broad parameters. But remember, this is a roadmap, and this is also a regulatory compliance issue. We welcome any suggestions for what we could do differently here, and nothing in these documents precludes us from doing something here that's separate and apart from what's in the plan.
So, Mr. President, I have a prior excuse absence to go to Jefferson High School for an exciting announcement around educational reform, so I'll be turning over the gavel to you.
Thank you for that explanation, Commissioner Fish. And Liz, could you just explain more about why some things are bold and what some things are not bold in the document?
Yeah, let me start with the process first, and then I think Kate can specifically address the bold piece. So it was a community-driven process. I'm honored to be able to have sat in that process. Kat has previously not been able to prioritize the AI before in the past, but has provided interviews. There was a group of over 20 stakeholders there at the table representing a variety of different landlord groups, there's tenant, legal services, disabilities, LGBTQ, your wide range of groups were represented. And we did go through a lengthy process of gathering data and hearing from different groups that collect information of these barriers to fair housing. We went into it with full intent on figuring out ways to meaningfully address fair housing barriers for folks. And one piece was the Fair Housing Council's audit testing and using that kind of data to really influence and help us decide how do we best as a community think we need to address these issues for the city of Portland and for Multnomah County, as it was a Multnomah County report. And so there is a number of us who had very lively discussions about different issues. It's an uncomfortable topic at times to discuss when we're talking about discrimination here in our city that we're so proud of. But we all went into it very intentionally and have all come out of it feeling good about the recommendations. We went around the room at the end saying, you know, how do we feel about this and can we support it as an organization? I was a little tough on some of the PHB staff as coming from the Community Alliance tenants representing tenants, but also our membership is predominantly made up of people of color, people with disabilities, mental health and physical disabilities. And so there is a number of our groups who pushed staff for recommendations that were a little bit stronger, that were comprehensive around enforcement, education, collecting better data so we can understand how broad this problem is, and then also looking at housing policy, those housing choices. We need more affordable housing, but it's also where do we have that affordable housing and how does it relate to the different folks who are having barriers to housing. We want to have an equitable city. When some communities are being discriminated, it does not just affect that individual or that community. It affects us all. We are all deprived of the richness and diversity of that. So we feel very confident. Everybody on the committee at the end signed off very positively about backing this AI report and the recommendations. There were specific pieces depending on the data that was gathered that we highlighted and was made really important. One area is disabilities. Both physical and mental health disabilities are often, that's a large area that is being denied housing or it has limitations receiving adequate housing that's accessible to them.
I believe, Elisa, that when we talked to Secretary Trezvenia on Friday, mm-hmm. I believe he said at the forum, that the number one category of complaints that HUD gets nationally is around disability. And and increasingly we're finding that people are experiencing barriers because particularly smaller landlords have not brought their properties up to ADA compliance. So mm-hmm. they're literally not accessible to someone that has a physical disability.
Yes, and mental health too is a large barrier. People don't understand how to work with folks who may have some of those challenges. It's just a different way of communicating with folks or working with folks. And so we are very proud, and you should all be very proud of the report that this committee came up with. It was difficult, hard conversations, but the recommendations are meaningful, and if implemented and funded, we strongly believe will reduce fair housing barriers in the community.
Thank you.
So, Kate, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to get the answer about
bold. Bold means immediate action. You will see those bold recommendations made their way into the city's Fair Housing Action Plan that Commissioner Fish brought out last week. You will also see that those have budget allocations across from them.
So if we could have some, if you could come and brief me on that action plan and maybe have some input into it before that comes to council. I greatly
Absolutely
appreciate will. The work and these good answers, as always. They're very well prepared. And thank you, Lisa, for your leadership of the Community Alliance of Tenants and all of the good work that's been done on this. Just one final question, and that is, are we allowed to tie ongoing tax abatements or other financial incentives to compliance with the recommendations in this report?
So that's a policy
question. Standards?
Yeah, that's, the council can condition, pursuant to the applicable law, condition any benefit it confers on someone on council on a policy that we adopt. So, for example, our partners in Oregon Opportunity Network have been talking for some time about linking tax abatements to meeting certain criteria. And mm-hmm. one could be compliance with certain minimum standards on fair housing. That's the brilliance of the work that Elisa has identified, is that this is pioneering work. The city has never had a report that was this comprehensive, based on data with a stakeholder group this broad, grappling with it. Now we're going to have a rich body of material to then make some policy choices, and linking benefits that we can confer on compliance with some legal requirements is certainly something that I'll be talking to council about.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
So, Kate, I want to make sure that I get kind of a broader overview of some of the issues here and give you an opportunity to clarify something I think you were a point you were trying to make earlier. We are approving a 5-year consolidated plan as required by the federal government to have funds dispersed to us that are used in the administration by Commissioner Fish in the construction and maintenance of housing for certain protected classes. Is that an accurate, broad overview of what we're doing?
Yes. Consolidated plan addresses all of the housing actions that we take for all qualifying homeowners, or for all qualifying households.
And one of the aspects that the report requires us to address is what the federal government defines as protected classes.
Correct.
And one of those protected classes has to do with sex.
Right.
So I don't want to leave an impression, if it's not accurate, that you have not addressed the issue of women being protected for housing. And it seemed to me that you were politely trying to say you have addressed the issue and you didn't expand on that. So I'd like to give you an opportunity to make sure that you can assure those that are watching that, in fact, the plan does address adequately protecting women who seek housing.
Thank you. I think, as Commissioner Fish said, in the Portland way, this report could be pro forma. The report, the consolidated plan, and the action plan could be fulfilling HUD requirements and going no further. Director Van Vliet described how we've done a purposeful job of syncing up the strategic priorities that we've identified to HUD with our specific Portland Housing Bureau strategic priorities. Similarly, we do a much more diligent or detailed job of syncing up the action plan items and the specific deliverables in this year's budget with what we're telling HUD. And then finally, the Fair Housing Action Report, the work of that committee went significantly further than the pro forma that was required. as Commissioner Fish has said, it's a valuable piece of work and stepped up a couple of notches from what we as a community have done before. So I think in the specifics of the report, we have gone beyond what would be required. We have specifically addressed barriers that were identified out of that process that would affect women who are experiencing domestic violence. And we did that.
Or how about just in general?
Just in general.
Yeah.
Yes. And we did that with it, and it wasn't just our words. It is literally the words of the community process that had community needs, a number of public hearings, and then the work of the committee.
So you're comfortable that we've addressed the issue of disparate treatment towards
yes.
women in a
Yes, sir, I am.
Great, thank you. Further questions? Thank you all for testifying. Sue, do you have anything else? Do we have anybody to testify?
No one has signed up.
Okay. Mrs.
Can I do a quick testimony? Sorry, I was a little late to sign
yeah.
up for it, and I'll try to be brief. So,
state your name again to it.
I sure will. So, Elise Aguilera with the Community Alliance of Tenants. So the Community Alliance of Tenants is Oregon's only grassroots tenant-controlled, tenant-run organization. Our renters' rights hotline has counseled over 2,500 calls this year alone from Portland residents calling us. On almost a daily basis, we receive calls about discrimination and mistreatment. Kat has been calling out these issues for several years now on a variety of different task forces and groups that we work on. The audit results validate kind of what we've been saying and what we've been hearing on our hotline from our members and from other tenant residents. We were not surprised to hear the results, but at the same time, it was still heartbreaking, and it brought up old feelings and memories from folks. CAT prioritizes the participation, our participation in the AI, because it not only represents us as a voice for tenants, but also for families, low-wage workers, people of color, people with disabilities, immigrants as well. Our membership, our board, our staff, and our key volunteers are primarily made up of these communities. So for us, we had a deeper stake in it than just the tenant side of it. So the Community Alliance of Tenants backs the AI recommendations fully and wants to offer support for Commissioner Fish's Fair Housing Action Plan that you guys will all review later on. We strongly feel that this is an important first step to meaningfully addressing fair housing issues, and you guys have the tenant support on that. So we hope that this is a model that can be shared with other jurisdictions and can get support from the city to help other areas to learn about the model that we have. It is new. It is innovative. It will make a difference if it is prioritized and funded. There are pieces that we have been actively working on it. We as a city here and you all as a council adopted additional funding for the neighborhood inspections program, which is one piece. Fair housing is not just about denying access into housing. It's dealing with folks when they're in housing and the mistreatment there as well, and then future planning for that. So I wanted to thank you for your time and being able to participate and share that with the council.
Thank you. Thank you, Lisa.
Bert, any further testimony from anybody present? If not, Sue, please call the roll.
Fish.
This is a monumental undertaking, so I want to begin by echoing what Margaret Van Vliet said and thank Beth Kay for her terrific work. These documents set forth our aspirations and our roadmap for the next 5 years. It will not be easy for us to get to where we want to go at a time of diminishing resources and greater need and the challenges we face, but I will say, as the Housing Commissioner, the reason I have confidence is because of the team that we have put together. So Margaret and Kate and Beth and Danielle and Jenny and everyone who worked on this, and Kim, thank you. Last Friday, we were joined by Assistant Secretary of HUD, John Tresvina, and we did a public forum in this room, and Jenny actually served as the council clerk for that and called people forward, did a great job. We had a couple hundred people who showed up, and they shared their stories with the secretary. And afterwards, he said some very complimentary things about our work and about our will moving forward to address barriers and to get the job done. We know it won't be easy, but we also know in the last year that we've faced incredible obstacles to doing our work, and yet this team delivered Bud Clark Commons on time and under budget. This team worked with the Home Forward to get a Hope 6 grant for Hillsdale Terrace, which brought an additional $18.5 million to our community. This team has been working diligently on a Fair Housing Action Plan, which we'll be presenting to Council shortly. This team knit together federal and local money to do a groundbreaking in Block 49 and on and on. During tough times, they're meeting the needs of people who need our services more than ever. But I also want to acknowledge that Margaret, in her leadership, said when she took the job she was going to do things differently. And she was going to do it more transparently, with greater oversight, and she was going to be more open to doing things in a way that perhaps were new. And she has fulfilled that pledge by putting together a Portland Housing Advisory Commission, which gives us guidance on all that we do, by putting equity at the heart of what we did every day, and by doing a comprehensive plan process that brought more stakeholders to the table and gave them a greater voice in how we were going to develop this roadmap. I'm very proud, Margaret, of your work and the work of the team. And now the hard work begins. And I appreciate some comments today of my colleagues, because it illustrates the dilemma we have going forward. Every day someone comes to us and says, there's a compelling need which we're not meeting. And certainly victims of domestic violence would be on the top of anyone's list. And every day we have to make judgments about scarce resources and how best to invest them. And every day we're confronted with 1,700 people sleeping outside and 15,000 households priced out from the market. And every day we deal with discrimination in housing, which prevents too many people from exercising choice that is protected by law. These are enormous challenges, and we as policymakers are going to have good, robust debates about who goes to the head of the line, how we spend our money, and which urgent need we do first. But make no mistake, this team has the demonstrated track record and the will to implement these plans moving forward and to make a difference, and I am incredibly proud to be the commissioner in charge of the Portland Housing Bureau. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I want to start out by thanking Beth Kay for all her years of service to the city and passion about issues of housing and homelessness. I'll start out where I said on my first question. I'll eagerly await this information request that's promised to me, but I still hold the perception that we are not doing as much for single women as we do for homeless men, single men, or families. And, you know, maybe when there comes a day we spend $47 million on a Bud Clark Commons for women in terms of a shelter, a domestic violence shelter, transitional housing, an access center, I'll sense some of that parity is there. But I do think, and maybe that's not the right solution, but I'm just saying, relative to the types of public investments we're making, we're not making enough in the needs of women, particularly women who need to get out of abusive situations. And whether it's more hotel vouchers or, you know, something as grand as the Bud Clark Commons, I don't know. But I do hold the notion we need to be doing more in this area. This conversation has been helpful, and I will be following up on this. But this is a good report, and again, thanks to all of you. Aye.
Fritz.
I thank Commissioner Fish for his leadership on this, and Director Van Vliet, and second Commissioner Saltzman's concerns and comments, particularly with regard to Beth Kay's wonderful work for the Bureau. Elisa, thank you for your work with the Community Alliance of Tenants. It's really great that you and other stakeholders put so much time into the advisory committee, and I agree, it's definitely the Portland way of doing things, and when we do things the right way, we tend to get really good results. You've heard on the Council that we are all very invested in the work that you do and want to be involved, so I look forward to working with you on the action plan. I'm concerned about single women who maybe aren't involved in any kind of criminal situation, whether fleeing domestic violence or having their own criminal challenges on the streets. There's a lot of women who are living outside who don't qualify for services because they aren't in those kinds of situations. And so I'm looking forward to having those discussions. As I mentioned earlier, I'm very pleased to see the focus on people with disabilities and on accessibility. I'm interested to hear Commissioner Saltzman's comment that that's one of the biggest complaints to HUD. And the whole discussion really emphasizes your commitment to equity, Margaret, and I appreciate you that, as Commissioner Fish said, it is at the heart of everything that you're doing. One of the pieces that's not involved in the report is about training staff about the requirements for the ADA. I remember recently, a couple of years ago, a new building in South Waterfront was not built ADA accessible because the inspectors, or it was just overlooked in the permitting. And I also remember being on the Planning Commission where being ADA accessible was presented as a public benefit. And I said, no, that's a requirement. That's not an additional public benefit. So I think that it's a discussion that we need to keep having and keep highlighting as we all age. And we know that 20% of folks in our community are people with disabilities. So I'm very glad to be working with you on that, and I'm very happy that we'll have the Office of Equity that may be able to provide some added value to the work that you're doing in making it more cross-bureau, and we can perhaps help with some of that education and training that, although the committee didn't highlight that as a first must do, perhaps within the City of Portland's government, that's something that we all need to pay attention to. We'll work with you on that as the Creation Committee for the Office of Equity continues to do its work. It's exciting to hear this report and to see the details and to know that we are all committed to this worthy work. Aye.
Leonard.
Well, I wished I could just say I am grateful for the work you do, but in listening to some of the exchanges, I have to say I have a great deal of empathy for you. Having to interact with the population that you do, which brings with it unique challenges in my own experiences in life, and then to constantly be second-guessed then by some of us up here about whether or not you're doing something we think you should be doing has got to be tremendously frustrating. So I will just comment to you that I have a background that deals with that population on a variety of levels. I appreciate the challenges that you deal with on a daily basis. I have a great deal of empathy for where you find yourself often. I greatly appreciate the leadership and work Commissioner Fish does, and if he hasn't learned this by now, I'm sure he is experiencing what it feels like to actually get out and try to do something different and not be comfortable in doing the way things have been done in the past. And when you do that, you obviously open yourself up for criticisms and people thinking you ought to be doing something different than what you are. From my observation, I think you're doing the best with what you have, and you have my support. Aye. Item 611.
Grant revocable permit to Periera Creperie on behalf of Ankeny Street businesses to close Southwest Ankeny Street between Southwest 2nd Avenue and Southwest 3rd Avenue from 7 a.m. June 20, 2011 until 11 a.m. November 1, 2011.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
How are you?
Please, whoever wants to take the lead, identify yourself and explain to us what we're doing.
Bruce Carey is going to start.
My name is Bruce Carey. I'm a restaurant owner in Portland, including Blue Hour, Sauce Box, 23 Hoyt, and Clark Lewis restaurants. I'm working on opening a fifth location in partnership with a Seattle company. Via Tribulani is the name of the pizza restaurant that we're working on opening at the corner of Southwest 3rd and Ankeny Street. So in that capacity, I'm here to represent the other restaurants and bars, the business owners on the what we call the Ankeny Alley between Southwest 2nd and 3rd, in hope that you'll grant us an expansion of our sidewalk cafe, closing the street so that we can place tables out in the street for expanded food and beverage service during a period.
Is that the Dan and Louie's Oyster Bar Street?
Dan and Louie's starts at the 2nd Avenue entrance, and then 3rd is where my business will be located. We've divided up the streets equally among the five or six participating restaurants and bars, and have agreed on controlling those parameters so that we can provide expanded use of basically expanding our dining room into the outside area.
Okay, and does this apply for that entire street? So in other words, can I enjoy a nice plate of Yaquina Bay oysters on the street during those dates and those times?
It includes service from all of the restaurants and bars between 2nd and 3rd, yes.
That's excellent. Questions or further comments?
Yes, my name is Jerry Jenkins. I'm with the Bureau of Transportation, and I want to thank Bruce for being here to talk from the perspective of the business owners. Some time ago, the business owners came to the Bureau of Transportation with the idea of closing Ankeny Street between 2nd and 3rd permanently. Through the course of conversations, we determined that a summer pilot program would be a good idea to look at how that proposal may work. And in the interest of being able to diversify the area in terms of service to the business patrons, the first thing that PDOT looked at was, or Bureau of Transportation looked at, was whether or not the street was needed for traffic circulation in the core area. The traffic engineer evaluated that, determined that the street was really serving as an alley, and in fact, as Bruce said, the businesses refer to it as the alleyway. Once we established that we didn't really need the street for circulation of traffic, we looked at other issues that may arise as a result of this request. We talked to the Fire Bureau about emergency access. We had conversations with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, the Crime Prevention Manager, Stephanie Reynolds, and the Crime Prevention Specialist for the area, and Teresa Marchetti, the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, Liquor Licensing Program Manager. We had conversations with the Police Bureau and received feedback from the various bureaus and entities and OLCC to add language to the ordinance that would meet the concerns that they had, and ultimately came to an agreement that this is an opportunity to have more eyes on the street and to sort of reframe the way the street functions now, which is essentially for a parking lot in the evening to store 6 cars and a pass-through for other vehicles to sort of circle the block looking for a place to park. And the vision for this street is to give the businesses on Ankeny that face Ankeny an opportunity to have a sidewalk cafe. And in essence, that's what we're asking, is to take the street and close it and redefine it as a sidewalk area and give the businesses on Ankeny Street the same opportunity that other businesses have in downtown Portland to have a cafe seating area. We will permit it as such to each individual business owner. It will be delineated as such, and it will serve that function for each business. In terms of actually closing the street, we'll change some signs. We will install a bike corral at the point of entry that will serve a dual function of meeting a need that the businesses have sought a bike corral in that area for some time, and it will also serve as a visual barrier that this is no longer, Ankeny is no longer functioning as a street for vehicular traffic. It's functioning more as the desire is that it's a cafe seating area for sort of a European flair, and that, you know, eventually people say, let's take a walk on the waterfront and let's walk up to Ankeny and have a beverage or a donut or a meal. So with that, we wholeheartedly support this closure and ask for council's approval.
Question on that. Actually, several transportation-related questions. One, as you say, people currently use that street for a cut-through to loop back onto 3rd. Especially, are you going to have a sign that tells people how to get back to Third if they, since they won't be able to use that? My concern is that people who are currently used to going down towards Burnside, they see Burnside, then they go down Ankeny to loop back on Third to continue to look for parking. If they don't know that you can't turn left off of Burnside for 10 blocks or whatever it is, that's going to create some challenges. Are we going to have some signs that tell people to go through to Cooch, to cross straight across Burnside and go to Cooch to turn to get back onto Third?
That's not in the current work order. We can add that to the current work order if we need to. The traffic engineer may be able to address that more specifically, the current, in terms of the need for that.
Sorry, go ahead and introduce yourself and we have a presentation.
My name is Carl Snyder. I'm a traffic engineer for Portland Transportation. We did not consider adding that type of signage when we looked at this.
Did you look at the circulation and the fact that people do use that rather than crossing Burnside?
Yes, we did consider that. I also checked with our data group to see how many cars use that street per day. And as near as I can tell, we've never actually counted the volume of traffic on that street before. And that sort of is an indication that it's a really minor use street, and it doesn't carry a significant amount of traffic.
Did we count this time, though? No?
We have not counted it, no.
So that's of concerns. My other question is about the sidewalks use ordinance. The sidewalks are currently 6 feet, right? So those are not places where people under the sidewalk management plan can sit on the sidewalk. But if we're going to now define the entire street as sidewalk, there would normally in a wider sidewalk be places for people to sit who can't afford to sit at a sidewalk cafe. So how does this relate to that?
Well, I think that the way that the sidewalks themselves will remain open and available for through pedestrian passage. In regard to your question specifically, I don't think it's unlike outside of the Heathman Hotel, where there are cafes that are set up. There's tables and chairs that are set up. They're used for this. They're permitted for the sole purpose of an extension of the restaurant to serve the patrons. And the area that's available for pedestrians to use is 6 foot in width and they're able to pass through but would not be able to sit down there as well then. I mean, and you know, currently right now there's, because it serves, it functions as a street,
but we're going to define it as sidewalk, so that would then create a wide enough sidewalk that you would expect to have a furnishing zone where people could sit if they wanted
to. We're defining it as sidewalk for the purposes of issuing a sidewalk cafe permit, and then we'll issue a permit to each individual business so that the sidewalks themselves will remain as the primary function of a sidewalk to carry pedestrians. And the street, which is currently used to carry vehicular traffic or store cars, would be utilized and permitted as a cafe, similar to any sidewalk cafe that has an exclusive use of that permitted area for the sidewalk cafe.
Are each of the restaurant areas going to be fenced off?
They will each delineate their space. That's a condition of the cafe permit.
So when the restaurant's not open, can anybody else go sit in the tables?
The tables and chairs will be pulled back similarly to how sidewalk cafes are now and stacked in a way that the area could be utilized as a pass-through area then.
But since we're doing this closure from 7 in the morning on June 20th till 11 on November 1st, and we're allowing alcohol in those areas, could anybody, during the time that the restaurant's closed, come and sit in that area and have a beer?
No, because we're allowing alcohol under a sidewalk cafe permit.
So what's to stop somebody from doing that?
The alcohol is allowed for service under a cafe permit, and I believe that it would be a similar type of situation to, again, a sidewalk cafe on a street that has been permitted to utilize that area for service of alcohol while the cafe is operating, and the rest of the time it's not functioning as a cafe. So it's not permitted.
I'm here. Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay, any further questions? Do we have anybody signed up or to testify? Or?
Michael Moore.
Michael Moore, okay. You can go ahead and have a seat.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You could just give us your name. You have 3 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Michael Moore, and